Cats, in 1978, one of the greatest horror movie franchises was born, in my personal opinion. Only 2 years later, another one would enter the world of horror. But weirdly enough, the villain that we associate with that franchise was really just another victim in the first installment. This swerve is so famous that it even became part of another horror movie franchise when Ghostface first asked Casey Becker, who was the killer in the first Friday the 13th movie. So how did the franchise that would see 10 sequels, video games, comic books, a TV series, and countless fan films start? Well, let's head to Camp Crystal Lake and find out. I'm your host, Sherry. This is just your friendly reminder that, as always, there will be loads of spoilers, like already in the introduction. So if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. Joining us today is Brian Rowe from Film at 50. Hey, Brian.
Hi. Great to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on. I've been on your podcast a couple of times, so I'm glad that you were able to come on and talk about Friday the 13th with us.
Yes, I love my scary movies. And when you said Friday the 13th, a movie I've never really talked about on any podcast, I was like, let's do it.
Nice, nice. So I'm going to ask you, tell us a little bit about your podcast, first of all.
So my podcast is called Film at 50. We talk about films that were released 50 years ago. And just year to year, whatever year we're in, we're looking at the films that were from 5 decades before. So we just got into 2023 here. So for the next 12 months, we'll be looking at the films of 1973, and it's every Friday. I have a new guest on every week, and we just pick a film. I try to pick movies that people are aware of. I'm not really picking like the really, really nitty-gritty indies that nobody's heard of, but we have some really great titles for 73 coming up, so check that out. That's Film at 50.
Nice. I was going to ask you, what are you most looking forward to covering in 2023?
2023, probably the one I'm most excited for is The Exorcist. That came out in December, and that is a really big favorite horror film of mine, and there's going to be a lot to talk about. I don't know how we keep that to under 2 hours, but we'll try.
Yeah, that's a tough one to keep to under 2 hours. It's such a great movie.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you the Scaredy Cat 5 questions. So we're going to talk about what you like in horror, what, you know, your memories around horror are, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What is your favorite subgenre of horror?
My favorite subgenre of horror is probably the slasher film. I grew up with slasher films. Those are the movies that my dad kind of introduced to me when I was young. When I was like 8 or 9 years old, he was showing me some R-rated slasher films from the late 70s and 80s, like Halloween and A Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. Nice. I think Friday the 13th came a little later. Like, the two that I remember from being really young are Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street, and I just really took to those, and I wanted to see all the sequels. And yeah, I was really lucky to not have parents who were like, you know, no R-rated movies until you're 16 or 17. Or like, they didn't. Like, my mom was a little bit more conservative in that regard. Like, she got really upset when my dad took me to Eyes Wide Shut when I was 14. She said, Ryan's not, he's not old enough for that movie. But I just begged my dad for weeks, please, I want to see this. So, but yeah, so I would say I love Christmas horror films too, and some other kinds, but I really love like the 80s kind of slasher horror film. That's probably my favorite.
Nice. That was going to be my next question for you, is if you have a favorite decade or a favorite era for slashers, but 80s is,
that's your jam. 80s is pretty great. Like, I have had Shudder for a few years, and whenever they have like a new movie on there, like a new movie like added to the streamer that is from the 80s that I've never heard of, that like goes right at the top of my list. Like, I want to see that. If it's like 1970 or 1998, I'm like, I can wait on that. But I don't know, there's something about that 80s. I mean, they're all trying to catch, you know, the big successes of Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. That's what a lot of those like mid-80s slashers are trying to do. But even the lesser ones are usually pretty entertaining.
They are. I would agree with you there. I recently did 100. It was supposed to be 100 horror movies in 92 days. I could not do it in 92 days. Wow. Yeah, it was rough. I took 2 extra months to do it. But I was like, it has to be 100 new movies. And I thought, okay, so what I tallied it up at the end. And I thought, where did I see most of my, like, what decade did most of these fall in? And oddly enough, most of them fell in either the 2010s or they fell in the 80s. So,
okay. Yeah, I feel like past the 80s, the horror films I like the most in terms of like the last 50 years would be the last decade we've had of these, like, you know, a little bit more thought-provoking horror films like Hereditary, which was my favorite film of 2018. Those kind of movies. Nice. And It Follows. I really like those as well. And we just came out of a really, real quick, we just came out of a really good year for horror films, 2022.
Yes.
Really loved X and Pearl and Barbarian and The Black Phone. Mm-hmm. And I just watched Smile last night. That was really good. And like, there's just been a lot of really great horror films in the last year, too. So I'm very happy about the genre right now, and I'm excited to see what happens next.
Yeah, 2022 was a really good year for horror. And like, for every, like, from your big blockbusters, your return of like certain franchises, and but also like even just like small indie horror movies. It was a really good year. A really good year for horror.
Waiting for that Friday the 13th remake or sequel. It's been a while, Jared.
It has been a while.
I'm sure we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about the sequels and the remakes and everything. We have to talk about, where is Friday the 13th? It's been a while.
So what is your favorite horror movie?
Halloween from 78. If I had to pick one, that's the one I can revisit the most. There's something like, there's like a mood to that movie every October that I have to re-enter. Like, that story and that the cinematography, the look of that film, just like the feeling it gives the viewer. I feel like there's just nothing like it. And it was made right before like the slasher craze really started. It kind of jump started the craze. And so I love how there's no real blood in the movie, and it's very simple and quiet and just really natural performances. And it's one of those rare movies. I can watch it every year and I never get sick of it. It's so great.
Same. Yeah. That's one of my favorites as well. And I have the exact same feeling about it, and I can watch it and still be scared, still have like the, it still has the same effect on me despite having seen it so many times. I remember watching it in, I think it was university, and we were watching it in the middle of the day, and we had to stop. Like, my friends and I were just like, I can't do this right now. Like, it was just just terrifying us. Nope. Let's just turn this off right now. But
yeah, I had that experience too. I was 10, I think 9 or 10 when I first saw it, and I watched it on, they were playing it on TV on Halloween night. And I was like, I'm going to watch this. I've heard some things about it. I think I had seen Nightmare on Elm Street by that point. My dad had shown me that, but Halloween was playing on TV and I said, I have to watch this. And I made it about 30 minutes in. I said, this is too scary. So I taped it. So I watched the rest of it the next morning, like when it was sunny outside and it was light out. I finished the movie.
Have you ever watched a movie, been so terrified by it, and then gone back and watched it and thought, why was I so scared of this movie? Because I had that with Wes Craven's Shocker.
Okay.
Again, watching it, it was late at night, watching it with a friend in high school, I think, maybe university, I'm not sure. And I'm very easily scared.
Yeah.
We started watching it and we had to turn it off. We couldn't finish it because it was so scary. And I never went back to it until probably about 5 years ago. And then I started watching it and I was like, really? This had me so scared that I couldn't finish it. But anyways, sorry, you were going to say.
Oh, I was just going to say the one that popped into my head was when I was a very little kid. I was scared by Madame Mim in the Disney movie Sword in the Stone. And I remember I was watching it as a very young kid. I have a memory of watching it with my grandmother, and I put my hands over my eyes and I kind of like turned away from the screen. And then I looked through the slits in my fingers and my grandmother was watching it. And I said, how are you watching this? It's too scary. I have a memory of that. And then that's you watch great. That movie now and you're like, what in the world was I scared about? That's kind of my silly memory of being that's scared great. As a kid, and then later being like, Brian, I don't think that was the movie to be terrified of. When I'm like 4 years away from watching Nightmare, it's like, what was that about?
So what was the first horror movie you remember seeing?
Like if you consider it a horror film, like I would say it's Jaws. I was 5 or 6 and I was at a friend's birthday party in the summer. And they played it. It was like at night or like evening, maybe. And like we did the presents and the cake. And then we put on Jaws. I think it might have been like 4th of July weekend or something. And I knew a little bit about it. I had seen E.T. I'd seen some of Spielberg's films. Like I kind of was aware of who he was, like maybe the first director I knew of. And I'd heard about Jaws. And it was about a shark. And I was kind of intrigued. I was probably 5 or 6. And at some point, it got so scary that I walked out of the room and I went upstairs and I played with my friend's younger sister in her bedroom playing a board game or something because I was too scared. And I was like listening to like the screams and I was like waiting to hear that the movie was over and then it ended. And then I went back downstairs and I rejoined the party.
That's great.
That one took me a few. Yeah, that one took me a few years to watch in full because it did scare me. I was always kind of scared of the water and the ocean and then sharks. And like when I finally watched the whole thing, I almost didn't make it again because of the scene where Quint gets eaten by the shark. I was like, oh, my God, that was one of the scariest images I had seen. I thought that was scarier than like Nightmare on Elm Street. Like I was like, this is too much. But yeah, so that took me a few times to get all the way through. So I would consider that a horror film. I mean, it's got that horror vibe with like not being able to see the shark and the way that Spielberg directed that. It's the closest thing he ever made to a horror film, that and Duel. So,
yeah, I would agree. All right. Who is your ultimate final girl?
I love Jamie Lee Curtis, but my choice has to be Neve Campbell in Scream. She's my favorite if I had to pick one.
Oh, okay. And why is that?
That's just that was a really influential series for me. Like the Scream movies, I saw Scream opening weekend at the end of 96 at age 12. I didn't know much about it, but I'd seen enough horror films by that time that the movie really was cool and fun to watch because I understood a lot of the trivia. And then something I think the Scream franchise has done really well, I think better than any other series, has been following not just one character, but a few characters like through their lives over the course of decades and seeing like how they've grown, maybe where they've hit some speed bumps along the way. And I think Neve Campbell as Sidney Prescott has really just done an amazing job in these movies. And the character has gone through some really intriguing arcs. And every movie, she's in a different place in her life. And Like in Scream 3, she's really down. And then Scream 4, she's doing much better. The recent Scream 5, she now has a family and is clearly mm-hmm. at a great place in her life. And so it's been fun to kind of see the evolution of that character throughout five movies. I think that is what that's what makes Nev Campbell, Sidney Prescott, the ultimate final girl for me.
I love that. Do you have any predictions for the new movie? The non-Sidney Prescott movie?
I am still not convinced that she's not in it. Like, I kind of feel like it could be an Andrew Garfield Spider-Man No Way Home situation where they, like, deny it for a year and then they show up. But at the same time, I think her reasoning for not wanting to be in the movie because of the low offer and her feeling she has more value, that felt very authentic to me, and that would be a weird lie, right? I don't think she's in six. Courtney Cox is in six. I've been intrigued mostly by the New York setting. That's the piece of it that I'm excited about. I really hope they don't kill Gale Weathers. I'm going to be pissed. Like, we got through the last big kill. I was able to, like, be on board with that because it made sense in the story and where mm-hmm. Dewey was. I was okay with that. But I'm like, don't you dare get rid of Gale. But, yeah, it's the New York setting that I'm most excited about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's like Ghostface takes Manhattan.
Yeah. it's the part 8 of Friday the 13th now is part 6 of Scream. But that was a good idea for them, like, to not just stick to not to stick to Woodsboro for the next two movies. Like, let's open up the world a little bit. I really like that idea.
Yeah, I like that it also kind of follows the pattern of one, happening in Woodsboro, and then in two, in Scream 2, the original series, mm-hmm. They moved off, out of Woodsboro again and went to school in Windsor College, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to me to kind of repeat that. So I'm excited to see what happens for sure.
Yeah. At the same time, I do feel like we're at the point with the Scream franchise where it could get into, like, self-parody at this point and feel kind of like we don't have much story here. Mm-hmm. Like, I the problem I have with the series right now is I've always felt this to be Sidney Prescott's story. Like, that's always been what's kind of brought me back and really excited about the sequels. And now that she was basically a cameo in Scream 5, she's only in the last, like, 20 minutes of the movie, basically, and then not apparently in 6, I'm like, well, where are we going with this? Like, what's the interest here? But outside of, like, the location and some of the returning characters, what are we doing here? Like, what's the overall plan? And I'm not really seeing that yet. So I'm crossing my fingers it works, but I think we're gonna feel the loss of Sidney Prescott in this new movie and not having her there at all. I think it will, come into my potential disappointment with it. I'm hoping mm-hmm. that's not the case. We'll see how it comes out.
Yeah, I think without Sidney and without Dewey, it's going to be a very interesting movie. So we'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens. How long would you last in a horror movie?
Oh, I'd be one of the first to go, for sure. Like, I was watching Smile last night by myself at home, and it was I had the house very dark. And there's some moments in that movie where there's that creepy smiling person in the shadow. Mm-hmm. And I look over to the left side of the room and it's very dark. And I thought, if there was someone in the shadows right there smiling at me, ready to come strangle me or kill me, I probably wouldn't even move. I think I would just sit here and just go, oh my God, as I'm killed. Like, I don't see myself being the final boy or girl in anything. So unfortunately, that's the truth.
I mean, at least you're honest. I used to always say that I would be one of the first killed, and now I'm like, I wouldn't even make it to the I wouldn't even be a victim. Like, I'd just be, and I said it in a recent episode, that I'd be the person. So in Scream 2, speaking of Scream, in Scream 2, Sydney has come out of her dorm room. It's at the very beginning, and she's talking to her roommate. And then one of the other girls from the dorm comes up to them and they're like, oh my gosh, guys, check out the news.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's who I would be. I would be the check out the news girl.
Yeah. Have you watched the news yet? Like, so yeah, exactly. Two more people died. That'd be your role.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Not the one taking down the killer.
No. Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. All right. Well, let's talk about Friday the 13th. So the Letterboxd summary is: camp counselors are stalked and murdered by an unknown assailant while trying to reopen a summer camp that was the site of a child's drowning. So very succinct and accurate. Do you remember the first time you saw Friday the 13th?
Yeah, I mean, it was around, I want to say I was 11 or 12. It was after I had seen Halloween and Nightmare. Those were the first two, like, big slasher films of that era that I saw. But Friday was a little bit later. I might have been 12 or 13. And to be perfectly honest, I was never as big a fan of the Friday movies as I was with Nightmare and Halloween. Over the years, I've definitely warmed up more to the Friday movies. They're really fun. I got that amazing Scream Factory box set that's got all of them.
Oh, nice.
With, you know, hundreds of hours of bonus features and commentaries and all sorts of cool stuff. And so it wasn't last year. I think it was maybe the pandemic year of 2020 when I had that set from Christmas or something. And I spent the whole year slowly watching every movie again and going through the commentaries. And it was a blast. They're not as thematically rich as the Halloween and Nightmares films. Like, those movies have more going on in them. But if you just want to kick back and have a fun time for 90 minutes, I really do enjoy the Friday movies. And I still think the best one is the first one. Like, I think the first Friday is the one that still works the best for me.
I agree, which is interesting because, as I mentioned, and as I'm sure most people know by this point, like, Jason isn't even the killer in Friday the 13th.
And he's barely in it.
He's the most famous thing to come out of this franchise. Yeah, like, it's very interesting. And to your point, I was thinking about that today, and I was like, I see why Halloween and I see why Nightmare on Elm Street became these huge franchises that still, like, resonate with people, you know, decades later. But Friday the 13th doesn't have the same depth, doesn't have the same, I mean, even I would say the charisma of the villain.
But there's a mysterious quality to Michael Myers that you don't really get with a guy in a hockey mask. There's something like, it's like, you're always intrigued, like, where is Michael? Where is he hiding in the shadows? And Jason will just, like, stomp into the room. Like, he's not really patient in that way.
No, he'll just break down the door and come in. That's true. That's my favorite thing in the Friday the 13th video game, is that you can just, like, bust down, like, doors as Jason and, like...
Oh, I gotta play that. I saw... What was it? I might have been on one of the later sequels. Like, they had Kane Hodder, I want to say, in a bonus feature where he talked about the game, and they showed footage of it. They showed some of it. I was like, I have to play this. This looks really great. You've done it before?
Oh, yes. I'm terrible as a camper or as Jason. Like, I never win either way, but I always have fun playing it. So,
yeah, that looks fun.
Yeah. So what do you think it is that makes Friday the 13th still resonate with audiences? Is it that just the fun factor? Because it really, like, you're right, it is a fun movie.
There's something to be said about a movie where you're just introduced to a lot of really kind of mediocre, thin, one-dimensional characters, and just the joy in seeing them knocked off in very unique ways is always really entertaining. And there is something to the franchise element too. I think if Friday the 13th was just two or three movies, I don't know if it'd have the staying power today, but because it's such a long series of movies they made over the course of 10 years, they made 8 films, which is kind of unheard of. It's pretty incredible how they were just pumping them out one after another for a while there. And just the entertainment factor, at least for me through the first 8, is pretty well there. Like, there's not really a lot of lulls in the stories. It doesn't matter who's writing, directing them. They're always really fun and entertaining, and there is something about, we see that now with Marvel and some of these things. Like, we love a franchise. We love kind of that, having that space to revisit a character and all of these horrific circumstances movie after movie. And so I think that has played a role in why it's still so successful. I don't think if it was just 2 or 3 movies, I don't know if it would have the staying power.
You know, you come back to Jason with, like, that familiar feel, right? You're like, I know exactly what I'm going to get out of this. Similarly to when you go see a Marvel movie, you pretty much know what you're going to get. And that's not a slam on Marvel movies, because I enjoy them, but you know, I think that's a really good point. You can put on a Friday the 13th movie and you know, for the most part, exactly what you're going to get. I mean, you know, maybe you don't know that somebody's going to be playing electric guitar and shooting a music video in the bottom of a boat, but you know,
I do think with Friday as well, like you can really put on any installment you want at any time. And it it doesn't feel like you need to have seen the one that came before, the one that came out. Like, I do feel like with Halloween and Nightmare, to just throw on Nightmare 5 or to just throw on Halloween 6, like, you're kind of lost. Like, you don't really know what's happening in some ways. Friday, you can throw on any of those sequels and it's fine. You don't have to watch them in order the way I do think you kind of need to for Halloween and Nightmare.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, like you think, and even like Halloween, you can throw on 6 after having watched 5 and you're still confused because that is the wackiest timeline of any movie franchise, yeah. I think. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the making of the movie. So it was written by Victor Miller with an original title of A Long Night at Camp Blood. Do you think the movie would have been as successful?
if it was called Camp Blood?
A Long Night at Camp Blood.
No, A Long Night at Camp Blood? No. Didn't they like advertise like the movie a year before it came out or before they even shot it with a big poster that said Friday the 13th? Yeah. I have a memory of that. Yeah. But they were considering this other title, the movie would not have had the staying power. I don't know if there would have been a sequel.
No, I don't think so. Sean S. Cunningham, who was the a director and one of the producers, had put out an ad in Variety in 1979 because he was like, I love this idea of calling it Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to make sure that they weren't going to get sued. Make sure that it wasn't already, a movie. So that's why they did it. And also because they wanted to like get a bidding war going because they were just a small independent movie. Mm-hmm. But there was apparently one movie previously that had been called Friday the 13th. And I believe they did attempt to sue them, but it sounds like some of the investors may have paid them off.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. There was a previous Friday the 13th. I mean, that would make sense. I was really surprised when I heard that Halloween had never been a movie title before 78. That was surprising to me.
So Victor Miller really wanted to create this serial killer who turned out to be somebody's mother. And basically the motivation for the murders was her love for her child. And he said, I took motherhood and turned it on its head. And I think that was great fun. Mrs. Voorhees was the mother I'd always wanted, a mother who would have killed for her kids. He then became very unhappy with the future decision to make Jason Voorhees the killer in the sequels, because he's like, Jason was dead from the very beginning. And he said he was a victim, not a villain.
Mm. Yeah, they kind of wrote themselves into a corner there to make this a franchise. Jason's not alive and the mom gets decapitated. So what, like, how do you make a sequel? Like, they had to basically do that with Jason to mm-hmm. make this a franchise.
So as mentioned, it was directed and produced by Sean S. Cunningham, who had previously worked with Wes Craven on The Last House on the Left. Mm-hmm. And he had seen Halloween and loved it and saw how this small independent movie made a whole bunch of money. And he was like, that's what I want to do. So he decided to capitalize on it. So it stars Betsy Palmer, Adrian King, Harry Crosby, son of Bing Crosby, Laurie Bartram, Mark Nelson, Janine Taylor, Robbie Morgan, and Kevin Bacon. And I will say, up until I was doing research for this episode, if you had asked me any of the names of any of the characters, any of the counselors, other than Alice, I would never have been able to tell you who was who.
I know. That's totally true.
It reminds me of a lot of like 80s slashers are like that, where you're like, I don't know who you are. I don't care who you are, but I just want to see you get killed, which is terrible.
Yeah, like I pulled up the IMDb and Kevin Bacon's name in the film is Jack. I mean, mm-hmm. Gun to my head, I probably would have gotten to Jack at some point, but it would have taken me a few minutes.
Yeah, same. Absolutely. So initially, the producers wanted Sally Field to play the role of Alice, but then they realized they couldn't afford somebody of Sally Field's caliber. So they went with Adrian King. Can you imagine Sally Field as Alice?
This is after Smokey and the Bandit. She was in Norma Rae in 1979, which won her the Academy Award for Best Actress. I don't think she would have done a slasher film at this period. Like, that would have been very surprising. No.
So Adrian King got the role instead, and she had previously appeared in soap operas. The part of Pamela Voorhees was initially offered to two renowned and Academy Award winning actresses, speaking of, before being offered to Betsy Palmer. Do you know who those two actresses are?
No, I might have popped up in one of those documentaries. I'm trying to remember. Oscar winning actresses? Shelley Winters?
Yes, Shelley Winters. Oh,
that was a guess. Yep. Because we just talked about The Poseidon Adventure, which she got a nomination for.
Great movie.
And I know she had won two beforehand. She kind of feels like she had done some horror films in the early 70s that feels like that would have been in her wheelhouse. She probably would have been great. Who's the other one? I'm not sure.
Estelle Parsons.
Oh, from Bonnie and Clyde. Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. Both of those choices would have been solid, I think.
I think so, too. And also, a connection between the two of them, which I never thought about, again, until I was doing research. But why would I have, I guess? But they would both go on to play play roles in Roseanne.
Right.
The original series as mother and daughter.
That's right. How random is that?
that's very random. So the producer sent a script to Betsy Palmer, who was like, this is terrible. This is an awful script. This is a piece of shit movie. But she needed a new car. And according to Crystal Lake Memories, the book, her car was going to cost just under $10,000. And they were offering her $1,000 a day for 10 days. So $10,000 would pay for her new car. So she took it.
Well, that's one reason to take a movie.
Right. In the book Making Friday the 13th, The Legend of Camp Blood by David Grove, she explained how she came up with her characterization of Pamela Voorhees. Being an actress who uses the Stanislavski method, I always try to find details about my character. With Pamela, I began with a class ring that I remember reading in the script that she'd worn. Starting with that, I traced Pamela back to my own high school days in the early 1940s. So it's 1944, a very conservative time, and Pamela has a steady boyfriend. They have sex, which is very bad, of course, and Pamela soon gets pregnant with Jason. The father takes off, and when Pamela tells her parents, they disown her because having babies out of wedlock isn't something that good girls do. Mm-hmm. I think she took Jason and raised him the best she could, but he turned out to be a very strange boy. She took lots of odd jobs, and one of those jobs was as a cook at a summer camp. Then Jason drowns, and her whole world collapses. What were the counselors doing instead of watching Jason? They were having sex, which is the way that she got into trouble. From that point on, Pamela became very psychotic and puritanical in her attitudes as she was determined to kill all of the immoral camp counselors. She put in a lot of thought into this character.
Yeah, it's interesting that she took the role because she had to pay off the car. You think she would have just shown up and said, what are my lines? What do I have to do? That she took the time to explore the backstory is kind of surprising to me. I really like that.
So filming took place in New Jersey in 1979, and the camp scenes were shot at a working Boy Scout camp, Camp Nobi Bosco. After seeing George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead, the producers hired Tom Savini to design the special effects for the movie. The music was by Harry Manfredini. I'm not sure. Did he do anything? I mean, I know he did other things, but was there anything of note that he did that you know of?
No. Do you have like a list of some other projects? Like, that's a very iconic score. You would have had other scores that I would know, but I haven't looked them up.
Well, let me look right now since I got it. He did, multiple Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. He did Swamp Thing.
Okay.
He did The Hills Have Eyes Part 2. He did House.
Okay. So strictly genre films then.
Yeah, mostly genre films. Yeah. Oh, Wolves of Wall Street. Oh, no. That's, yeah, Wolves of Wall Street.
The Wolf of Wall Street with DiCaprio?
No, Wolves of Wall Street. Oh, my God. I was like, am I looking at that right? No, it is a 2002 American horror film about werewolves.
Oh, okay.
Werewolves on Wall Street.
I was like, wow, that would have been a big boost to his career. Holy cow.
Yeah, that seemed like a big jump. Yes. So the movie was released on May 9th, 1980, nowhere around a Friday the 13th, which I think is very funny.
Yeah.
You would think that that would be something they would look for. And their budget was $550,000. Box office was $59.8 million.
Wow. That's insane. It's so funny that Cunningham saw the success of Halloween and said, I want to replicate that. Let's do something similar and make a lot of money. And then it happened. That's kind of, you don't see that every day. Usually a producer's like, give me another one of those. And then it underperforms often. And that wasn't the case here.
It was the 18th highest grossing film of 1980 and had to compete with some other pretty big releases, horror releases specifically that year, like The Shining, Dressed to Kill, The Fog, and Prom Night.
Did Friday the 13th do better than those movies? Like, The Shining wasn't a huge hit, I want to say.
That's
it came
true.
Out in May of 80, I want to say. And I don't think it did very well, like, on its first run at the theaters. Like, The Shining became kind of a cult movie in the years that followed, I want to say. Like, I cannot see The Shining making $60 million at the box office in 80. That doesn't seem possible. Because I know Eyes Wide Shut was the only film Kubrick directed that opened at number one. I do remember reading that.
I love that that was, like, a movie that you begged to see.
Begged. And when we walked out of the theater, my dad turned to me and said, "If your mother ever sees this movie, I'm a dead man." That's what he said.
Number one that year was The Empire Strikes Back. No surprise. The Shining was a 14th.
Okay.
The 14th highest grossing film of the year.
Really? That surprises me. That doesn't feel like a movie that would have been successful in theater. Interesting.
No, it definitely, it beat out Dressed to Kill, The Fog, and Prom Night, which actually none of those surprised me that it beat.
Okay. Interesting.
Reviews, not surprisingly, were not great. Linda Gross of the Los Angeles Times referred to the film as a silly, boring, youth-geared horror movie, although she did give credit to the score, the cinematography, and the performances, which sounds like she did like quite a bit. Variety called it low budget in the worst sense, with no apparent talent or intelligence to offset its technical inadequacies. Friday the 13th has nothing to exploit but its title. It got a lot of unfavorable comparisons to Halloween, where people were like, "You can see that you're trying to rip this off, and you did not do very well." And of course, there was a lot of criticism around its depiction of violence. The Hollywood Reporter said, "Gruesome violence in which throats are slashed and heads are split open in realistic detail is the sum content of Friday the 13th, a sick and sickening low-budget feature that is being released by Paramount. It's blatant exploitation of the lowest order." Michael Blowen of the Boston Globe referred to it as nauseating and warned audiences, "Unless your idea of a good time is to watch a woman have her head split by an axe or a man stuck to a door with arrows, you should stay away from Friday the 13th. It's bad luck." The film's biggest critic was Gene Siskel, who called on people to write to the studio and to Betsy Palmer herself. He, in fact, actually gave out her address.
That's right. I remember this.
To express their disgust. He spoiled the ending for people as well. He said who the killer was. And then he and Roger Ebert spent a whole episode of their show berating the film. Like, he absolutely hated this movie.
Yeah, Siskel did not like horror films at all.
No. Yeah. There were a few I feel like that he surprisingly liked, and I can't think of any off the top of my head, but it is very, very rare.
Yeah, he liked Scream 2. He gave Scream 1 a thumbs down, and Ebert was very high on Scream, said it was a really solid entry in the horror film world. But then Siskel came around on the sequel a year later. He thought it was funnier and better written. But for the most part, I mean, his most famous thumbs down is probably Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
He said was a piece of junk on air, and Ebert was just staring at him like, "What's wrong with you?" So I was like, what was going through Siskel's mind when on Oscar night a year later, the movie was winning everything? Like, that must have been a weird night for Siskel.
It probably was, eh? That's true.
It's like, maybe I was wrong on that one.
He's like, "When I get home, I'm going to watch this again."
Maybe look at this a second time.
And even retrospectively, so a lot of movies, especially horror movies, given time, critics come around to them and they start to like them.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is not one of those movies. Critic Kim Newman in a 2000 review gave the film 2 out of 5 stars and called it a pallid Halloween ripoff with a mediocre shot count and a botched ending. As the bodies pile up amongst this testy crowd of horny teens, there remains a vacant hole where someone scary should be. Mm-hmm. In a strange way, this film stands unique amongst all slasher films as the one where the killer is nearly intangible. And then Scott Mieslow of The Week in 2015 said, "Before it became an absurdly prolific franchise, Friday the 13th was a cynical one-off attempt to make a fast buck on a sleazy slasher movie that accidentally ended up spawning a decade-spanning multi-million dollar phenomenon. What's most striking about Friday the 13th is how little regard anyone but its fans seem to have for it." I mean, even when you look at like Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street, and those franchises, like, critics a lot of critics really loved them. And so, but it sounds like Friday the 13th has just, like, its success has strictly been propelled by fans and their willingness to go and see these movies over and over again. And even, like, this is not my favorite franchise. Halloween is my favorite franchise. Mm-hmm. I call myself a Halloween apologist because there are some ridiculous things that happen in that franchise.
Yep.
But a local theater played two random Friday the 13th movies, not even in order. I think it was 5 and 8 they played. Yeah, because it was Friday the 13th, and those were probably the ones that this theater could get, like, the licenses to. And I was like, yes, I'm going to go sit for 4 hours and watch two of the most random Friday the 13th movies in a theater.
That's funny. I could not see myself watching 5 and 8 back to back in a theater. That would just be very strange.
It was very weird. So, plot synopsis. So the movie opens in 1958 at Camp Crystal Lake, mm-hmm. and we have a group of counselors. They're sitting around the fireplace in one of the cabins. They're singing away. It's very wholesome. And then we have two of the counselors who are apparently named Barry and Claudette, but I don't think they're ever named in the movie. Maybe it's in the script. They decide to sneak away to have sex, but are rudely interrupted by an unseen assailant who proceeds to kill them. So the first kills are within 5 minutes and I think 22 seconds, which is pretty fast.
Yeah, it's pretty quick that we get a couple kills in the movie. I think that was probably an idea from Cunningham, was like, especially studying the opening of Halloween, mm-hmm. you need to open with a kill. Like, we can't have this be 30 minutes of exposition.
We fast forward 21 years and we meet Annie Phillips, a young woman who just wants to work with kids, although she hates calling them kids because she says it reminds her of goats. And she is headed to the soon-to-be-reopened Camp Crystal Lake. Like, Annie always seems to me like she's going to be the final girl, even though I know she's not. Like, she's mm-hmm. got that final girl vibe at the beginning, but no, she does not. So,
yeah, I always think that too when I watch the first film. It's like we definitely set her up as the character who's going to be there at the end, and that's just thrown away very quickly.
She meets some locals in town, notably Crazy Ralph and Enos, a truck driver. And Crazy Ralph warns her away. He's like, don't go there. You're doomed. You'll never come back if you go to that camp. But Enos just basically brushes him off and then continues to tell her all about the camp and the problems it's had in the past. And you're sure you want to go there? So he basically does exactly what Crazy Ralph does, but slightly more rationally, I suppose.
Exactly.
He tells her about the murders and the drowning of a young boy a year before the murders. But that was like 20 years ago. So, you know, whatever. It's fine. He drops her off, not at the camp. He only takes her part of the way. And she gets a ride with someone else, someone whose identity is not revealed to the viewers. We don't see them. And the driver continues on past the camp. And at this point, Annie naturally gets a little nervous and ends up escaping from the car. So she runs through the woods. The killer chases her and ends up slashing her throat. So now we have like 3 kills in, what, 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
But surprisingly, like, even – I don't think any of these are really – well, Annie, I guess, does get her – not – yeah, Annie gets her throat cut on screen. But you don't see a lot of it on screen. Even the two at the beginning, you don't see the girl die. You just see her screaming in slow motion. And you do see the guy tumble over on the floor and he's got, like, blood coming up – like, blood on his shirt. But you don't see the actual violence. So for a movie that is, like – panned for being so gory and so violent, there's really not that much.
Yeah, we only stay on her slit throat for what, 3 seconds maybe, and then it mm-hmm. fades out, I want to say. And then Robbie Morgan plays Annie. I remember it was on one of the bonus features on the box set, and she, when she goes to conventions and things, her big sign is always the first kill in the Friday the 13th series. I guess you would consider it on screen kill, because we do have a couple deaths at the beginning, but they're not really like, do we see the guy get killed? Like, it's very brief. It's pretty quick.
You just see like him like fall over at one point.
Yeah, he just like falls over. Like the first like actual blood kill is her, and she takes great pride in that.
Yes, she does. I was watching one of the special features on my DVD set. I don't have the fancy Scream Factory one. She said that her husband used to always introduce her as, this is the first kill in Friday the 13th.
I would do the same thing. That's a kind of a neat, you know, something to put on your tombstone.
Yes.
You know,
totally should be. So we now meet the other counselors at camp. We have Ned, Jack, Bill, Marcy, and Alice, and they are currently working on fixing up the camp before the children arrive. We also meet the owner, Steve Christie. His parents previously owned the camp and have been through a lot of trouble trying to get the property up and running again. But everything is very fun and jovial. The counselors are joking around. They go swimming. But there's a momentary scare when Ned struggles in the water and they think he's drowning. But no, he's really just playing a prank. And Ned is actually credited as being the kind of that the start of the prankster in slasher movies. Like, because he also does the thing where I think it is it Brenda who's walking by the archery range and he like shoots an arrow very, very close to her and she freaks out. So Steve heads to town for some supplies. He decides to leave the counselors alone because they're, you know, they're old enough to look after kids. They're old enough to look after themselves. Even though there's a thunderstorm about to break, it's Friday the 13th. There's a full moon. There's a killer on the loose, which I guess they don't know yet. It's also Black Cat Day. So this is, you know, bad luck all around. It's not going to end well for anyone. So then Ned is the next victim, which I have to say, thank goodness, because I don't know that I could deal with his pranks for the whole 90 minutes.
Yeah.
As he follows someone to a cabin, and we next see him when Jack and Marcy sneak away to have sex, and his body is in the bunk above them, throat slashed. Marcy gets up to use the washroom. Jack is the next to die, and probably one of the most famous death scenes in the whole franchise, with his throat pierced by an arrow that comes up from under the bed.
So good.
It's so good. So tell me, do you have a favorite death scene in the Friday the 13th series?
Oh, in the whole series?
In the whole series.
Oh, gosh. I'd have to think about some. I like the girl who gets stabbed in the neck when she's eating a banana. And is that the third one? There's at the beginning when she's just eating a banana and then she just gets stabbed in the back of her throat. and you just see her like her mouth open like, and then you see like some banana like falling out of like off her tongue as she gets stabbed. I'm trying to think of like a really creative kill. I've always liked probably like one of the more like shocking and like seriously disturbing ones is Crispin Glover getting killed in the fourth movie, where he just gets that machete to the face and that like, and when he like opens his mouth wide, like you can like feel his pain in that split second before we cut away. I've always thought that was a powerful kill. And then of course Jason is, you know, killed in a lot of these sequels really fantastically, you know, all of the different, like I love in part four when like he like falls on top of that machete and it goes through his whole head. But he's still like blinking one eye, still like alive and like like thinking, yeah, in that moment. Like, oh my God, could you imagine? There's a lot of good ones.
Oh yeah. I think two of my favorites that just stick out in my head. Well, there's the sleeping bag kill is iconic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But the two that always come to mind for me are the person that gets dipped in liquid nitrogen.
Jason X, that's a good one. Yeah.
And then smashed to pieces. And then the other one is in Jason Takes Manhattan. When he like punches the guy, like punches his head right off.
Oh, right. He punches the head off the guy. That one, after the guy's been doing, isn't it like 90 seconds, 2 minutes of him like getting ready to fight?
Yeah.
And he's like getting into his mode of action. And then Jason just punches his head up.
Just ridiculous. And for some reason, like it just sticks with me. So
those are all good.
So Marcy is in the washroom as this is happening, and then she ends up getting an axe to the face. Mm-hmm. And while all this is going on, we have Brenda, Alice, and Bill. They are playing strip Monopoly, but they end up calling it a night when Brenda realizes that she left her cabin window open and it's now pouring rain, so she has to get back to her cabin. She's getting ready for bed. She settles in with a book before hearing someone call for help outside. She hears it a couple of times. So she goes out. She ends up back on the archery range when all of a sudden the lights come on, like blindingly bright. But then we flip back to Steve, who has finished his errands. He's grabbed a snack at the local diner, but gets stuck in the mud. And the only reason I can think of that they have the scene at the diner where he's talking to the waitress and it's literally him just paying his bill. The only reason that I can think of them having that scene in here is just to make sure that you don't think that Steve is the killer.
Mm.
But yeah, that's a good point. because there's really no other reason for that scene. So one of the local police officers starts to drive him back to the camp before being called away to a bad accident. So Steve arrives back at camp. He comes face to face with the killer and recognizes them. And you think Steve probably should have stayed in town because he ends up getting stabbed to death. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Alice and Bill start to worry about their friends. They leave the cabin to look for them, and they start to find clues that things were even worse than they expected. There's an axe in Brenda's bed, phones have been disconnected, and Ned's truck isn't working. And then, of course, the power goes out. And these kids don't have the benefit of knowing all, you know, that we know about slasher movies.
Yes, it's not Scream. They haven't seen other horror films. They don't know what's going on.
Exactly. Bill leaves Alice to check on the generator, but when he doesn't return, she goes out to look for him, only to find his body riddled with arrows and stuck to a door. She naturally runs away to hide, and one of my favorite little mini scenes, but we'll get to that in a minute, and ends up being even more terrified when the killer throws Brenda's body through the window. Yeah. She sees a car outside. She thinks it's Steve, so she runs out to him, but instead she finds a middle-aged woman named Mrs. Voorhees. She's like, I'm an old friend of the Christie family. I used to be the cook here. And then she reveals more about her history at the camp. Her son, Jason, was the boy who drowned back in 1957, and she blames his death on the counselors who weren't watching Jason and instead were off having sex and singing Kumbaya. They weren't singing Kumbaya. So she has a vendetta against camp counselors, and she is ready to kill Alice. The two of them have a pretty weak fight. Like, when you compare it to, like, future fights between a final girl and the killer,
yeah,
it's a pretty weak fight. But Alice manages to knock her out with a pan before running to the lake. Why she goes to the lake, I don't know. There, Mrs. Voorhees comes at Alice with a machete. Alice gets the upper hand and gets the machete herself and comes for her and ends up decapitating her. Mm-hmm. After all this, she is naturally tired. So she climbs into a canoe and falls asleep. She wakes up in the sunlight. The canoe has drifted away from shore. It's peaceful and calm. The music has changed. It's very soothing. Until the seaweed-enrobed body of Jason emerges from the water and attacks her, pulling her down. The next thing she knows, she wakes up in a hospital, a police officer and a doctor at her side. When she asks about Jason, the officer tells her that they didn't find a boy. And they almost, like, wink. It's like they practically wink at the screen. And she says, then he's still there. And we see the lake once again. And that is how the movie ends.
Which, by the way, we talked about Deliverance a few months ago from 1972, the thriller with John Voight and Burt Reynolds, very famous thriller. And it ends the same way that Friday the 13th ends.
Like it, really?
Like it ends with John Voight, like seeing a hand coming out of the lake, out of the water. And then he wakes up and he's like, oh my God. He's like, oh, thank God. It was just a dream. And then the film ends with a long shot of the lake, and then it fades to black, and then roll credits. Yeah, it was very surreal and strange. Like, huh, 8 years before Friday the 13th, we get a very similar ending. I wonder if Cunningham had seen that. I bet he did.
Interesting. Because everything that I've heard, they credit the ending to Carrie, like having seen Carrie.
Right. There was that thinking of, we need to end with a jolt. We can't just end with, like,
yes,
kind of a womp womp, like she's just in a hospital bed, mm-hmm, kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, because it wasn't in the original script. And then I've heard, like, a couple of different people have kind of claimed credit for it. Like, Tom Savini is one of them. Victor Miller is another, where they're like, no, I saw Carrie and I thought, you know, that's how we end this movie.
Yeah, but if you ever get a chance, even if you just watch the last 2 minutes, like, watch the end of Deliverance. It's very similar.
Interesting. Oddly enough. All right, so overall thoughts about the movie.
This is a total blast. It's very much like, you can feel in the sequels that they're a little bit more like catching up to a trend. I don't really feel that in the first movie. It doesn't feel like we're only here because of Halloween. It definitely feels like its own separate kind of thing. And what I think is so cool about the first Friday over, say, the first Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street is that it is a slasher film. It's also a mystery, like a whodunit. Like, who is the killer? We don't know for the majority of Friday the 13th who is being, who is actually killing these teenagers. That's also what makes the movie a lot of fun the first time, because you don't know. And you would never suspect that it's this sweet older lady. Like, that's very surprising when you see it the first time.
Yeah, and the first time you see her, I think you're like, oh, there's somebody here who can maybe help Alice. Yeah.
In like a sweater. She looks very like warm and inviting. Like, mm-hmm, someone you could trust, which is really cool about that casting, too.
Agreed. What are some of your favorite scenes?
I think some of my favorite scenes, I'm trying to think if there's any I really like outside of the kill scenes. I like the girl at the beginning walking into town, and there's that guy who like you know, yells at her like, "Don't go to that. Don't go to that camp. It's not good luck." Yeah. Like, I like that kind of setup. Like, something is awry here. The characters in the first movie, outside of like the main female lead, are pretty clunky. You don't really get to know them or like them very much. I almost feel like some of the sequels have better teen characters overall. This movie, they're pretty disposable in the first one. Like, in the scenes where no one's getting attacked, you're kind of like, all right, let's get to the next kill.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, when you look at some of the future characters that will come in Friday the 13th, like, not that I think Friday the 13th is ever going to be a movie that, or a series that people say had strong character development, but you don't have a Tommy Jarvis. You don't have the girl with the telekinesis.
In part 7.
Like, you don't have any of those characters in this movie. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I agree with you that you want to get to the next kill. You're like, okay, do I really need to see them like sitting around and like, you know, like playing strip Monopoly? Yeah. No, not really. But I also like that it feels very, I don't want to say real, but maybe I do. Because it, you know, when you're that age and you're just kind of hanging out, they're waiting for these kids to arrive. So everything is kind of boring. And mm-hmm. like, they're just doing things to pass the time. Is it something that necessarily is exciting to watch? No, but I feel like that maybe they accidentally made something that's a little more realistic in between kills than they anticipated.
Yeah. And I feel like when I rewatch the first one, I'm always just kind of waiting for Betsy Palmer to show up. Like, for me, on rewatches, that's the section that I'm most interested in, because she does not just phone in her performance. Like, it's a really weird killer movie performance. And like, all of the little tics she has, you know, the killer mommy, killer, like, it's so weird. And you're like, was this like specifically directed to her on the day? Or is she just like taking that from the script and like coming up with it herself? I'm like, I'm really intrigued, like, all the choices she made, how much of it was she just directed to do? But that's a long, I mean, she's in the movie for a while, right? Isn't it like 15, 20 minutes? It's not like, yeah, she doesn't just show up and get decapitated. It's like a few scenes of like them fighting, and then Alice runs away, and then there's more fighting. And the fighting is also just really clunky in a way that delights me. Like, there's just like, when she just like, they just like kind of fall on each other, and there's like, it's like, how did this woman murder all of these other people?
And like, so stealthily.
She's not very gifted in the moments with Alice. It's just, it looks like she doesn't know what she's doing. So that's the section of the film I like the most. I mean, I've seen it 10 or 12 times, probably, maybe more. And that's the last third is my favorite part.
Yeah, I think I have a lot of the same favorite scenes, but like the first appearance of Crazy Ralph, as you said, like, but even like Annie showing up at the store and everybody kind of giving her that look like, why are you going there? Like, and like you said, you know, something's amiss. Something is wrong with this camp. And like, why are you going? And then you've got Crazy Ralph, who is the one that is, well, he's named Crazy Ralph. So he is, you know, outwardly insane, but he's actually like the harbinger saying, don't go there, this is really going to happen to you. But they also do a good job of kind of making you think, well, could he be the killer? Like, and then he shows up at the camp, so possibly, right. I mean, I think when I first saw Friday the 13th, I already knew who the killer was, but I can see how that would happen, like, because I didn't see it obviously in 1980, I would have been 4, but like, I saw it when I was a teenager. So, you know, everybody knew about Jason Voorhees at that point. Although maybe I thought it was Jason Voorhees, who knows?
That would have been a different movie if it was like the little
very
boy.
Yeah.
Killing everybody.
I love Annie's chasing and the lead up to her death. Like, you get the killer POV, which is now very common in slasher movies. And Halloween did a great job with it. But you've got that music and the chase through the woods, and she's stumbling, and it kind of set that tone for something that would become very popular in slashers, is that running through the woods and that chase scene. And then just before she dies, the music completely stops. Like, there's no sound. Mm-hmm. Like, well, no sound. There's no music. And then she gets killed.
Yeah. I don't really like how she doesn't really stand up for herself. And this is also the case with the girl in the bathroom. That's how true. Instead of like, it's just kind of, they go, no, you know, and I love the girl in the bathroom who's just like, She just kind of like whines as the axe comes down. Like, I think
she does.
I think even though we both admit we'd be one of the first to go, I don't think I would stand there as someone towered over me with like an axe. I don't think I would just go, like, I think I might like step back at mm-hmm. least. Mm-hmm. So that's the only thing I don't like. I do like that scene too of the girl at the beginning who's gets killed in the woods, but I've never liked how she just kind of sits there and goes, no, no. And then she gets her, like, she doesn't
very
put up
passive,
any, yeah. It's very passive. Like, yes. There's no fight that's put up
that's
there.
Very true,
so I wish
very
there true. Was at least like a little bit more of a struggle would have been good. I don't know.
Particularly, yeah, like I really noticed that this time watching it, the girl in the bathroom, I think Marcy, she really does do that. And especially like you're not even going to have defensive wounds. Like, there's nothing to show that you tried to save yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And to our point earlier, it's like Pamela Voorhees. Like, would you really be that like, if Jason's towering over you, okay, maybe you're like, oh no, but like, try to fight back against Pamela. You don't even need to put up that big a fight, as Alice shows us. Like,
yeah.
And then I love Kevin Bacon's death. Like, I like that you see Ned's dead body in the bunk above them. Mm-hmm. And so you know that this is going to end badly. And then there's that drop of blood that hits his forehead. Then the hand comes up from under the bed and grips his forehead just as the arrowhead comes through his neck. And it's got one of my favorite pieces of horror movie trivia, because apparently they're like, the tubing didn't work properly. Mm-hmm. For the like the blood spurts. And so Tom Savini's assistant, Tasso, and I can't think of his last name, comes up, and he actually went under the bed and was blowing through the tubing. So that's why you get these like kind of spurts of blood coming up.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you seen the new Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special on Disney Plus?
No.
So all I'm going to say is, I'm not going to give it away, but I think you'd like it, because there's a piece in the episode with Kevin Bacon where he refers to this scene in Friday the 13th. It's pretty freaking hilarious. I laughed my ass off.
Oh, nice. I will watch it for sure. I will definitely watch that. And then there's also the scene where Alice barricades the door, but she barricades a door that opens out. Mm. So like, it is really ineffective. Yeah. And you're just like, how are you our final girl? Like, Alice is the final girl is just, it's so arbitrary. It could have been any of them. Any of them could have been the final girl, really.
I do think she's the one, though, that, like, there's, like, the most humanity in her in some way. Like, you kind of, like, even in the first half of the movie, like, she's the teenager that I'm most interested in. Like, there's something about her vibe that I really dig, and I like that she's the one they chose to be the final girl. It makes sense to me.
All right, that's fair. All right, best scare. Is there anything that scared you in this movie?
Anything that scared me? The only part that's still a little bit scary is the final jump of Jason in the lake. That's the only part, I think, on repeat viewings that's still kind of a jolt. Like, is there anything else in the film? Maybe Kevin Bacon's death of the of stabbed through the mm-hmm. neck. That's still kind of like, whoa. But it's that last scare on the lake that still works really well.
I also like when Brenda goes to the bathroom after Marcy's been murdered, she's brushing her teeth and she kind of looks towards the shower curtain as if she heard something, but nothing's there. So she looks away and we see this hand grip the side of the shower curtain. So we know that Pamela Voorhees is in there, but she has no idea. And it's just this little tiny thing that I think it's just particularly in this setting where you're like, the killer could be hiding anywhere. And there she is literally feet away from her. Mm-hmm. And we know what this killer has already done. So I think that, and at that point you're like, oh, Brenda's, like, her countdown has begun, basically. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And I think that's the area that's also a weakness to this movie compared to, say, the first Halloween and Nightmare, is that you do care about the people in those movies more. Like, even Annie in Halloween, you know, and, like, her friends in Nightmare, like, you care about them, like, when her best friend is murdered at the beginning of Nightmare, you really mm-hmm. feel it and it's horrifying and you're like, oh my God, this is terrible. And in Friday, you don't really care. And that's part of the fun of it. But I do think, like, if there's one thing they could have done, at least for this first movie, is just made the teen characters a little bit more interesting with a little bit more personality, I think could have made the movie even better.
Yes, for sure. All right. Emotional impact. I feel like there's, did you have any kind of emotion? Did this movie have any kind of emotional impact on you? Probably not.
Well, I mean, if there's anything, it was that for the first time I recognized like, oh, like an older, sweet, kind woman could be a serial killer. That was the first time I thought that.
That's a good point. And I think that's something that really like turned, that maybe set this apart from other slashers is that they really were like, we're going to give you somebody that is going to 100% surprise you as the killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a daring choice. That might not have worked if they had hired the wrong actress. Like, that might have been weird. But mm-hmm. Betsy Palmer really brings it and makes that section of the movie work so beautifully.
Yeah, she sells that monologue that you were talking about earlier where she's like, kill him, mommy, or kill her, mommy. And
yeah, or just when she's telling, like, she's just talking about why she's doing this. And, like, she just talks in a normal voice. Like, that part, it feels real. It feels scary. It's like, we can't trust this woman. And then she's kind of clumsy in her trying to kill the lead girl. So I'm like, maybe I don't buy that she had all of these nifty kills in her earlier in the movie. But in terms of her acting, like, she's definitely the strongest actor in the movie, at least at that time.
Yeah,
like Kevin Bacon's great, but he's very early on. Like Kevin Bacon would develop his craft in the decades to come and in later really great performances. But here he's not given much to do.
Mm-hmm. This is one of his first movies, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe his debut is Animal House in 78. Mm-hmm. And then this is his second or third film. Like this is before Footloose. This is before he becomes a star in the mid to late 80s.
All right. Any random thoughts, anything we haven't talked about that you want to talk about?
I mean, you mentioned Tom Savini. I think his work here is really great. I think did he come back for a sequel? He might have come back for the fourth one, if I remember right. But I love Tom Savini's makeup work on all of these horror films. He does such a great job on Dawn of the Dead from 2 years before this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a little, when you watch like the girl who gets killed in the bathroom and then we get that shot of the axe against her forehead, you can like see the latex, you could see like where her skin ends and then like the latex begins. Some of it's a little clunky, but that decapitation at the end is gorgeous. Like that is really well done. Like it looks very real for mm-hmm. a cheap slasher movie. So I just wanted to mention his name once more. I think he's a genius. I think he's so great. And I love all of the work he did for these late 70s, early 80s horror films. Really wouldn't be the same without him.
Very true. I love, do you know how they did that scene, the decapitation scene?
Well, I mean, we don't see the head, like, we don't actually see the machete connect. But I want to say, yeah, it was on the one of the documentaries. I'm trying to remember exactly. Do you have that in front of you? Like how
I do. So they took, and I don't know all the details, but they basically, the first day that Betsy Palmer was on set, they made like a model of her head. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how Tom Savini brought his pet chinchilla with him. Mm-hmm. And so she'd have like this model on her head and or latex, whatever it was. And she'd have like grapes or dried grapes or something, which would be raisins, but I'm sure I saw dried grapes. But anyways, she would put it in her lips and the chinchilla would like eat it. That has nothing to do with the decapitation scene. It just was something that really stuck out for me. But they basically took that model and they attached it to like a model of a body, I guess, and with toothpicks so that as soon as the machete hit, the toothpicks broke and the head went flying. And then when you see the hands come up, that's actually his assistant, Tasso. Those are his hands. And you can actually see, if you watch very carefully, you can see that they are hairy man hands, definitely.
That's funny. Mm. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, but it's a really great moment. Like I imagine like opening weekend in a crowded theater that got a big round of applause, right?
yeah. That and I feel like the end scene would just have like – the audiences would have gone crazy for, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of the success of the first movie was that end moment with Jason coming out of the water. I don't mm-hmm. know if the movie would have been as popular without that final button. Like, that's really important.
I'd also just like to call it the score, because I think the score is mm-hmm. incredible. And I guess they wanted a chorus to actually be part of the score, but they couldn't afford it. And so Manfredini had I want to say some Polish composer that he was a big fan of. And he'd heard something by him that basically just repeated certain like consonants that kind of sounded like a chorus, which is where he came up with the like infamous sound.
So good.
So good.
Like that helps when you create a score that when you just hear 3 seconds of it, 30, 40 years on, like, you know what that's from. Mm-hmm. Like that's really important, like to create an iconic score for a horror film. It pays off big time decades down the road when everyone can recognize it so easily.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if you haven't seen it, even if you have never seen Friday the 13th, you know it. Yeah. Exactly. It's like Jaws, right? Jaws is the same way, I feel like. Okay. So body count. We had 9 deaths and 1 real snake. The snake that they kill was actually a real snake.
Right. Oh, I remember hearing that. Yeah.
And according to one of the actors, and I don't remember which one it was, they said they looked over and they saw the snake's like trainer just like looking on with like tears in their eyes. And it's like, that's heartbreaking. Cannibal Holocaust gets a lot of like flack about, you know, killing of the turtles scene, which I have not seen that movie, but mostly because of that.
Yeah, I've never seen Cannibal Holocaust. I've watched a couple like documentaries about it. I've never had an urge to watch it. It just sounds kind of like a snuff film and I don't like that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
I'm good.
Yeah, same. I just think it's funny, you know, like they kill a turtle and everyone knows about it, but like Friday the 13th, they kill a snake and I'd never heard that that was a real snake until I was doing research for this episode. So double standard is all I'm saying.
Exactly.
All right. So time to rate the movie on a scale of 1 through 5. How many scaredy cat screams would you give Friday the 13th?
I think I give it a 4 out of 5. I couldn't give it more than that. Like, I don't know if this movie gets like a 5 out of 5. It's not at the level of some other horror films around that time, but it's a lot of fun. And it's one of those you can put on at any point and just have a good time with. And, you know, the score and the scares and that last 20 minutes is really fun. Like it's a good watch. I like the Friday the 13th series. And I do think it starts off really strong with the first movie.
Agreed. Do you have a favorite sequel?
Yeah. Like I really like 3 and 4, like those are the two. And I think 6 is also really good. If I had to pick a favorite, it'd probably be the 4th one. I feel like there's a little bit more story in that. I feel like the characters are a little bit more developed in the 4th one. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time they were planning on that being the 4th and final. It's called the final chapter.
Yeah.
So you do feel a sense that there's some finality to Jason at the end. And then everything with young Corey Feldman, I think it's a little clunky at the end of times with his bald head. But it's also I like that element of it. Like it feels like everyone making the 4th one is like, this is the last one. We got to go out big. We got to do something really cool. And then so you feel that watching the 4th one, that it's not just a disposable sequel. Like it feels like they're trying to make it really good, which I appreciate. I mean, there's things I like about the other ones. Like I like some of that crazy stuff with, you know, her using her mind to destroy Jason in the 7th one. And Freddy versus Jason's a lot of fun. I like that movie a lot. But yeah, if I had to pick my favorite sequel, it's the 4th one.
Nice. Are there any that you're like, that was just terrible? I see no redeeming qualities in that movie.
The 5th one's pretty rough because it's not him.
Like,
For me, it's like, even if it was him, it'd be in the bottom 2 or 3. But then you find out at the very end that it's like a copycat. And that's why they had to call the 6th movie Jason Lives. Because it was like, oh, we're bringing him back for the 6th one.
Yeah, so yeah, don't worry, folks.
It's like the 5th one's like okay when you watch it the first time, but once you find out it's not him,
yeah,
multiple rewatches is not like that's the one when I had the box set and I started in January, February a couple years ago of like, okay, we're gonna watch him again. I was kind of dreading the 5th one. I was like, oh, and the 5th one had like a bonus commentary, like they had done a new commentary, so there were, I think, 2. And I'm like, am I really going to watch both of these commentaries for the 5th movie?
And I did.
And I kind of regretted it. I'm like listening to the conversation. It was kind of interesting at times, but I'm just like, yeah, if I had to remove 2 of them, it'd be the 5th one. And then I admire some of it and what they're doing with it, but Jason Goes to Hell is a tough watch. Like, that one's just like, what is happening here? Like, we're going to blow up Jason, and then his spirit's going to invade all of these humans that we don't really care about. And it's got a couple really nifty kills, which I admire. Mm-hmm. But in terms of rewatches, the hardest ones are number 5 and number 9. The other ones I can watch anytime and they're fun.
Yeah. And what about the reboot?
Oh, I don't really consider that a sequel. I've only watched that twice. I saw it when it came out in 2009. And then I watched it again for the box set, which that was like, it's like when I have my Halloween box set and I get to the Rob Zombie movies. I'm like, ugh. And because I really don't like those two movies. And then it's kind of the same thing. It's the guy who made Marcus Nispel, I think his name is, the director. He made the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake in 2003, which I thought was pretty solid for a remake. And then Friday the 13th. It's like, it's so like in the middle. It's not a terrible movie like I think Rob Zombie's Halloween is, but it's just like so middle of the road and forgettable. Throwaway. You know, it's got, you know, a pretty decent cast. Mm-hmm. It's got Jared Padalecki, who I've maybe had a crush on for the last 20 years. And is maybe at his like peak hotness in Friday the 13th from 2009. Like, that is like the hottest he's ever looked. So that element might bring me back again. But it was that era of let's remake everything.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really a whole lot of style or thought put into some of those movies. It's not as bad as the Nightmare remake, which is
That's literally what I was just going to say.
Like, so bad. I remember seeing the Nightmare remake opening weekend. I'm like, life is too short. Like, this is ridiculous. So I was happy when that trend ended. Like, we stopped. I think they just ran out of movies to remake. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened. But I would be curious to see, like, so it's been 13, 14 years since the Friday remake, and we haven't had a Friday movie since. The remake was, if you count Freddy versus Jason, the 2009 remake was the 12th movie. Mm-hmm. Like, there has to be a 13th Friday the 13th, right?
I mean, you would think so. Like, if they can't just stop at 12 when they're called Friday the 13th. Like, they need to do like a
big. So that's been kind of bugging me. I'm like, we have to make one more. And the Halloween films from Blumhouse have been so successful, have been huge money makers, that you have to think that someone is considering doing another Friday. I think for a few years here, it's been like tied up with some, like, there's been some behind the scenes problems with the copyright and with like what studio it's at.
Yes.
I think that's been the issue, right? Yeah. I haven't looked into it, but I think that's the problem with it. And I don't know if that's going to be solved anytime, but it kind of baffles me when I see how successful these last three Halloween movies are. It's like, hello, like, why aren't we doing one more Nightmare or one more Friday the 13th? We have a new Exorcist coming out in the fall, which will be its 50th anniversary, which is kind of interesting, which we'll have to talk about. But I'll be surprised if we don't get another Friday in the next 5 to 10 years. It feels like enough time has passed and there's still a huge fan base for it. And they're not very expensive. It's like, let's do another one. We're not going to end with that remake. We got to do one more.
Yeah. Well, I think Brian Fuller is doing a, like a prequel, right?
Oh, okay. Is that what they're talking? Every year I see a new story like, oh, here's the new Friday in development, and here's what it's about, and blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, I'll believe it when you go on IMDb and it says not in development, it says in production. Like, when they're actually shooting something, then I'll get excited. But until then, I'm like, well, it's like Freddy versus Jason for a decade was all sorts of different kinds of movies. And I remember in the mid to late 90s, I was reading up like, oh, this is what's going to be Freddy versus Jason. Blah, blah. Uh-huh. And then it finally happened in 2003, and it was a different kind of thing. So I don't know. I feel like there's room in the horror realm right now to bring back Nightmare and Friday the 13th. but in a way that's kind of a partly a sequel to, and it's not just another remake. We don't want to do that. So that's what I thought the Halloween films were successful in, is like bringing back a character we know and having it be kind of a sequel, but also having it, you know,
be its own thing,
be a love letter to the franchise as well, but not have it just be, let's start over from scratch. It's also kind of acknowledging what came before. So I would love to see that someone do that with Friday, who really loved that franchise. So we'll see.
Is there a director that you could picture doing it, or that you would want to see doing it?
Can you imagine if it's just David Gordon Green? They just have, they have him do.
Well, he's doing The Exorcist, right?
They have him do Exorcist, and then he does, and then he does Nightmare, and then he does Friday, and he's just like, he's just, you know, racking in the cash. He's like, this is my new gig.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Who would be a good director? I would love. What would Ari Aster do with Friday the 13th? That would be.
I mean, you've got like family trauma, you've got guilt and grief, so it could work. It could
imagine work. A Friday movie that was like on the level of The Craft of Hereditary and Midsommar. Like, imagine if that kind of a style was given to a Friday movie. That would be amazing.
Oh my gosh,
that's my vote.
I like it. I'm gonna back you up there.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on to talk about Friday the 13th with us today. So tell us where we can find you. Tell us about your podcast and where folks can listen to that as well, because I highly recommend that they do.
Yeah. So I have a few things going on. I have the podcast Film at 50. You can get that anywhere you listen to your podcasts. It's also on YouTube. And then I have a YouTube channel called Brian Rowe Video, where I talk about all things Oscars every Tuesday. I bring out a video about Oscar predictions or about Oscar history. I do a lot of cool videos. I've been doing that since the end of 2021. You can find that on YouTube. New video every Tuesday. And then I'm on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Brian Rowe, MR Brian Rowe on Twitter. And I also write for In Session Film and Gold Derby right now, writing film reviews. And soon I'll be doing Sundance Film Festival coverage In Session Film. I'm going in person for the first time in 20 years since I was in high school. I'm finally going back to Sundance, and I'm going to have a full report for In Session Film. So check that out.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. So I'm going to ask you a quick question about the Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on the Toni Collette was robbed for Hereditary train?
Yes. One of my most successful tweets in the last year was, I think, so for me, there's two performances of the last decade that should have been nominated. And it just grinds my gears. The first one is Toni Collette for Hereditary. I think she should have been in the running to win for that performance. But it's just too much of a weird genre movie at the end of the day. Because I would sometimes compare it with, well, Kathy Bates won Best Actress in 1991 for Misery, which is a horror film, a Stephen King adaptation. Mm-hmm. She won for that. And that's kind of an erratic performance. So well done. And I think Toni Collette is on her level in Hereditary, has so many amazing scenes of emotion. And it's very much her story, but it just goes to some really weird, disturbing, supernatural places in the last half hour that I think that's what kept it from getting her in. And I understand that, but at the same time, I'm like, how do you look at that performance and say, no, not good enough? I think that was the one case where we overlook the fact that it's a genre movie and we nominate Toni Collette. She has the one nomination for The Sixth Sense, so she has that nomination. Mm-hmm. It's not like they don't like her. And I imagine there were some rumblings about it, but it was a summer release. It didn't come out in December or anything. It wasn't like fresh in everyone's minds come January, February, so I get it. But even more so than that one, I think Jake Gyllenhaal does his finest work in Nightcrawler from 2014. And he got in at Golden Globes. He got in at SAG, I think. He got in at Critics' Choice. I think he got in at BAFTA. And then he didn't get the Oscar nomination.
Oh. He's incredible in that movie.
So good. Physical and emotional transformation. And he is like, he's the whole movie. Like, he is so great. And it got a screenplay nomination. It just does not sit well with me that Gyllenhaal was not nominated for that movie. He should have been in the running to win for that performance, and he didn't make the final five, which is just really upsetting. But yeah, so it's him and then Toni Collette for Hereditary. There is a huge fan base for that movie online. And when I, whenever I share something about how Collette wasn't nominated for Hereditary, there's a lot of likes and a lot of comments. Trust me. Maybe I'll pull it out again for this upcoming season and be like, remember back when Collette didn't get, and then everyone will just pile on and be like, oh my God. Yeah, that was ridiculous. Yeah, she should have been nominated for that performance. She's so amazing in that movie.
Should Betsy Palmer have been nominated for Pamela Voorhees?
No. But I applaud her anyway. She was great.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCatsThePodcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts. And don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.